From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, it's The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, Pay Up Hollywood has grown from a hashtag to a movement as assistants in the entertainment industry call for better pay and working conditions. Then the lineup for the next Sundance Film Festival is out, and it's packed with filmmakers who represent diversity of every sort. So how does the festival's director see Sundance's role in Hollywood?
We have a rare opportunity. We get to prove that other kinds of films about other kinds of people actually work for an audience.
And we mark the centennial of a landmark production studio in L.A. All that coming up on The Frame. Assistants in the entertainment industry are overworked, underpaid, and often have to run personal errands for their bosses, even after they leave for the day. That's according to a new survey of more than 1,500 assistants. It was released this week by the grassroots movement called Pay Up Hollywood. The campaign started as a Twitter hashtag back in October and has been gaining momentum since then. Katie Kilkenny is an associate editor at The Hollywood Reporter, where she covers labor, and she explains how the hashtag grew out of an episode of Script Notes, a podcast about screenwriting.
A assistant wrote in saying, you know, I think one of the big issues that's going to be coming forward in the next few decades in Hollywood is that we're going to have to talk about the low pay that assistants are facing and how that is related to rising cost of living in Los Angeles. And from there, the hosts, which are John Aucas and Craig Mazin, who are both really powerful writers in Hollywood, read that note and asked for more people to talk about their stories of being an assistant in Los Angeles. And they just got an overwhelming amount of email. And a writer named Liz Alper, who is on the board of the Writers Guild of America, started a hashtag called hashtag Pay Up Hollywood.
So a couple of days before Thanksgiving, Script Notes facilitated a Pay Up Hollywood town hall where assistants had a chance to talk about some of the issues. And here's what one woman who didn't provide her name had to say about burnout.
We almost have like three jobs at once. Like, not only are we working our day job for 40 to 60 hours a week and not making enough, and then therefore we're doing work on the side, like babysitting, driving, etc., but we also have the work of our own careers. And I think that is like what leads to that burnout, because we're not only expected to have this day job that like puts all these things in place for us to move forward, and then on top of that, we're expected to have like an hour to write a day or to fund our own short films and make them on the weekends. Like, that is just like impossible.
I think impossible is an accurate word for what she's describing. What were some of the other issues that came up around the hashtag and around the town hall?
So I think a big one is the question of access. You know, Hollywood has been talking a lot about its diversity issues and wanting to get more folks into the pipeline of diverse backgrounds. But what we're looking at here is a situation where you have to be able to afford to be an assistant in the first place to get that first leg up in the industry. And so Pay Up Hollywood has just released a survey of 1,551 assistants, and they found that 78% of the people who were surveyed were white, and that 52% were receiving financial aid from family and friends to make ends meet as they were assistants in Hollywood. So I think we're seeing that this industry, in order to diversify, does have to become more accessible, more economically accessible to folks who aren't coming in with that aid. So that to me was notable, as well as the fact that a lot of assistants were also talking about the sort of demeaning work conditions that were expected of them. You know, Hollywood has a pay your dues culture, and I think a lot of folks remember some difficult work conditions when they were assistants, and so sort of expect that their assistants will have to go through that as well. But in this survey, it showed that 104 respondents had an object thrown at them in the workplace. So I think that we're looking at conditions where assistants are not only being pretty badly paid, but also they are facing work conditions that are pretty rough.
We're talking with Katie Kilkenny at The Hollywood Reporter about Pay Up Hollywood. There are other things that really jumped out to me. One is that almost 93% of those people surveyed said they work more than 40 hours a week, and 15% said they were working more than 60 hours a week. And here was something that was really troubling. Almost a quarter said that they had reported an increase in substance abuse. So it sounds like the job is really taking a terrible toll on the people who are in this line of work.
Completely. I mean, I think these numbers sort of show something that, you know, assistants have been talking to each other about for a long time. And so I think for a lot of assistants, this is not a surprise, but this survey really shines a light on some of these issues and the fact that things need to change.
And it sounds like some showrunners are actually saying this is unsustainable and maybe even immoral.
Absolutely. So I talked to a few folks who had been vocal on Twitter with their support and basically found out while I was talking to them that they were advocating for higher wages on projects that they're currently developing. And these are Adam Conover, who folks might know from True TV's Adam Ruins Everything, David H. Steinberg, who was a co-showrunner on Netflix's No Good Nick, and the writer, producer, creator, Islet Waldman, who was an executive producer on Netflix's Unbelievable. Waldman in particular told me that she was trying to get her assistants $20 an hour plus benefits. And Conover was saying that he was trying to adjust various aspects of the job to make it more tenable.
You said in your story that you had reached out to the major studios and talent agencies for comment. And let's just say they weren't flooding the phone lines calling back. Have any of them had anything to say?
One agency is doing something, and they didn't provide comment for the story, but you know, I heard via sources that Verve, which is the talent agency that represents both John August, who helped create this movement, as well as Liz Alper, who coined the hashtag, has conducted an anonymous pay survey of their assistants. And we'll also be receiving and looking at the results of the Pay Up Hollywood survey. And I imagine that in weeks to come, others will speak up more. But for now, they are remaining mum.
And even if the hours are horrible, the working conditions aren't great, a lot of people want these jobs, right? Because it's so hard to get into the business. And this is one possible path for people who want to become creative people in Hollywood.
Definitely. They're extremely competitive jobs. And often a line that is used with assistants who want to speak up about work conditions is that, you know, there are thousands that will take your place. But it's gotten to the point where the wages are the same as they were 20 years ago in some cases. That's what we're hearing from a lot of these stories, while the cost of living in Los Angeles has skyrocketed. And so these assistants' argument is that the situation is untenable at this point.
Katie Kilkenny is an associate editor at The Hollywood Reporter. Katie, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Coming up on The Frame, the lineup for the Sundance Film Festival is out, and we've got the details. Today, the Sundance Film Festival announced the lineup for the 2020 Fest. Documentaries include movies about the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, survivors of the Parkland shooting, and Taylor Swift. Features include a movie written, directed by, and starring Viggo Mortensen, and the latest feature from Ben Zeitlin, who made Beasts of the Southern Wild. For January's festival, the Sundance staff watched more than 15,000 features and shorts from 27 countries. Kim Utani, the director of programming, and festival director John Cooper oversee the selection process. Having walked out of my fair share of bad movies before I've even started in on my popcorn, I was surprised that Sundance programmers actually watch every submission all the way through.
If I'm the first one to watch a film, I'm committed to watch it all the way through and really be able to stand by the whole story. And sometimes, you know, we see a lot of rough cuts actually too. And sometimes that's the part that is easily cleaned up and does happen in the time leading up to the festival.
As trained curators and programmers, we know that the worst thing to happen is that we miss a film and it goes on to play another festival and does really well. And so for us, our biggest nightmare is to not have watched a film all the way through and to have covered it as it should have been. And also, I think that in terms of our relationships with filmmakers, like, we respect all filmmakers, and the fact that they have put their time, money, tears, and sweat into a film, like, we respect that. And so we watch these films from beginning to end and judge them from there.
We have to find 125 films that we love that are as good as they possibly can be to make an event that is going to go out in the world. So it's in our best interest to find really amazing work. So that's what we're looking for.
And how do you achieve consensus or some version of consensus? Because there are going to be movies that make it into the festival where two reasonable people can say, I love it, I hate it. How do you figure out if there's such a split of opinion?
I think that's the game of it, but Kim and I talk about this a lot. Our roles in that room of really intelligent, smart people is to read the passion. What is it? What is, where's that passion coming from? Is it almost authentic? I sometimes ask a trick question. I throw it in. Do you love this film? And if they tell me it's important, I go, that's not the same as loving a film. So they're intellectualizing it. I am always trying to get to the emotional impact of a film as well, even if it's a very intelligent film. Like a film like The Report is not a highly emotional film, but it was highly intelligent. But I still got a lot of emotion out of that.
It almost sounds like you were, in some ways, therapist working with a couple. Like, tell me what your real feelings are. Don't tell me what you think I want to hear. Really explain how you feel honestly about what it is we're talking about.
Exactly. And I think that that was the main transition that I had to make moving into being director of programming. Is I used to be able to come into the room and have my own argument. Now I have to listen to everybody's arguments and come to some kind of conclusion about like the voices in the room and to figure out what we do from there.
That was hot, my hardest transition too, because I was a big mouth in the room from the beginning, and I liked that role. What and do you mean?
And you don't have to listen to anybody else.
Yeah, I don't have to, only myself, you know. And then all of a sudden you're holding up a different part of the responsibility for making a great festival.
And how do you know when a movie works? I mean, is it something that at this point is intuitive, that you feel it in your gut, even if you can't explain it?
Absolutely, for me. That's how I process everything. There's other people on the staff and who have been on the staff before that come from a very academic, thoughtful approach, almost logical, and I have none of that. I truly don't. It's all about how I feel and what I feel would feel like being in the audience for that film. Is it working? Is it? At the same time, I've adapted a huge appreciation for different genres, more than maybe I would in a normal life, because you know you're going to get all those films. And you're really representing the films that our independent film community make. So you have to be open to the most experimental, to the most horror movie. There's no really genre that you cannot appreciate.
I think that is precisely what we do as programmers. You almost have to leave your own taste behind and approach each film with an open mind and to not have any kind of expectations of a film. I feel like that is oftentimes what can mess you up as a programmer.
We're talking with John Cooper and Kim Yutani about Sundance 2020 at their offices in Mid-Wilshire, Los Angeles. There are 16 films in the U.S. dramatic competition, and in the press release, you note that 47% of the directors are women, 52% are people of color, and 5% are LGBTQ. At what point are you aware of the demographics of the filmmaker, and how does that factor into who's in and who's not?
I don't really look at it till we're done.
What happens if you have 75% men and 10% people of color? Is that okay? How do you adjust? Because at a certain point, if you're doing it blindly, that might happen.
Yeah, you're right. That might happen. And if we did our job, then that's what happened. At the same time, we do in our final, I say when we're done, but we're done and then there's a moment where we reevaluate, I think,
where
the program.
We fine-tune.
And we will. I've gone back many, many years ago. I've gone back and looked at films like, God, did we miss something on this? I've gone home that night and watched four films in a row just to make sure we made the right decision. We didn't miss something.
What do you think the job or responsibility that Sundance has in Hollywood? I mean, we're on Wilshire Boulevard now. Not far up the street is the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. I can look over at Century City where ICM and CAA are. Their studios not far over the hill. How do you define your role in this community?
We have a rare opportunity. We get to prove that other kinds of films about other kinds of people actually work for an audience. And that is the power of it. It's a power that we've earned over the years. So that's not how it started necessarily, but I know that that's something that we do and I take it very seriously. And, you know, actually, I think they understand. We're not against them. They need us. It is hard. Look at how many films we have to go through. Look at how many people. We do a good deal of work for them. You know, they can come and see all the work we've done and do the right thing for those people a lot of the times. Get them other jobs, hire them, take them to big films, let them do small films, whatever.
Kim, when you look at the overall list of films across all categories, what are your takeaways? What do you think this year's crop of films and filmmakers represents?
What I see is a distinctive quality. I think that there are films that we're playing that are big, there are films that are small, there are films that are intimate, and there are films that are that have celebrities. The fact that we can have all of that in one program is an exciting thing for me. I think that we do an incredible job of curating films out of the huge number of submissions that we get. And for us to be able to assemble a program that represents so many different people, so many different viewpoints, so many genres and issues in the world is no small feat. And I'm really proud of the program this year.
So narrative filmmakers aren't some monolithic group that get on group chats on Facebook, but they do tend to focus on similar themes from year to year. What did you notice thematically this year that people were really obsessing over and wrestling with?
I think it's anything with human connection. I think maybe it's the world we've been living in for the last couple of years, but family is one that's real. That whole notion of I don't want to say dysfunctional families, it's functional families that are different. What is a true family in America today? You look at Glenn Close in Four Good Days as a mother trying to, you know, hold her kid together. I would say, you know, Uncle Frank about this crazy family and everything that they go through. There's just so much. The Father about adults dealing with a father with dementia. And they're not broad strokes. These are very detailed stories of family that are clearly quite wonderful. Different cultures, but maybe it's just from different problems in that family. But that seems to be something that's tying a lot of the films together.
Kind of like The Farewell last year.
Exactly. And we're seeing that audiences really have an appreciation for knowledge about other kinds of families. It's a way in to thinking about new stories about America.
Kim?
From the doc side, I think that that we, over the past few years, have seen a lot of films about extraordinary people doing extraordinary things and making real contributions to the world we live in. And I feel like this year we're seeing a lot of films about movements or groups of people, like something like Crip Camp or Us Kids, where people are banding together, bound by their beliefs and their beliefs that they can change the world.
Sundance has a pretty good record, especially when it comes to men, of filmmakers who come to Sundance with a low-budget movie and then end up making something much bigger at a studio. How do you feel when that happens? Because it's kind of like losing a kid to go to college or something like that, that they have grown up and they often don't come back. They make their independent film, they establish their career, and they go make studio films. How do you feel about both raising that person in a way and losing them?
You answered your own question because they're going into the world with the best possible thing, an education behind them. It's like you're sending them to college. So that is the good news.
They've graduated. I also think, too, that it's fine if people evolve out of Sundance because that just creates more room for new voices.
What I love is when they go into that other realm, but they take the independent spirit with them. Ryan Coogler did that. And that's what I even talked to them more about. Go out there, do whatever you want, but don't lose yourself in this because we need you in these movies.
Up next on The Frame, a walk through a landmark production studio in Los Angeles. I'm John Horn, and this is The Frame. When I Love Lucy hit the airwaves back in the early 1950s, it was the first primetime comedy produced in front of a live studio audience on the West Coast. Now, a bronze plaque hangs outside the Lucy stage at the Sunset Las Palmas studio on Santa Monica Boulevard. Las Palmas is one of three lots that make up what are now known as the Sunset Studios, and they're marking their centennial this year. While the studios are among the most historic places to film in L.A., the Frame contributor Marcos Najera explains how they're also a part of Hollywood's future.
Once upon a time, four brothers bought a piece of dusty farmland on Sunset Boulevard. Their last name was Warner, and the year was 1919. The brothers Warner built a studio and started making movies, but it wasn't long before they packed up and moved to Burbank. Well, we're moving on now. We're moving on now. And what they left behind were buildings and land that helped start a storytelling boom. From classic TV hits like The Jeffersons and Gunsmoke to more modern fare like Jeopardy and Judge Judy.
What? There's only one person here that has attitude.
Even KTLA's nightly newscast.
Tonight, before we go live, be the first to know the big story.
As well as the film that would change the town forever, the 1927 movie The Jazz Singer.
Wait a minute. You ain't heard nothing yet.
Up on a silver screen, Al Jolson sang with a black face. But perhaps even more surprising for the audience was not just what they saw, but what they heard.
Nothing but blue skies from now on.
For the first time in forever, people watching a movie could listen too. This was Hollywood's first feature-length talking film, and it was shot at Sunset Studios.
Now get this. Blue skies, smiling at me, me.
I feel like the Hollywood gods and the goddesses are there in spirit.
That is writer Norma P. Sepulveda.
And it's just a wonderful experience to get a little bit of the old with like this supercharged new reality.
These days, she comes to the lot at Sunset Studios to pitch projects to Netflix, who moved into their new shiny headquarters here just 2 years ago.
I feel like those turnstiles are like the gate to the creative heaven. You know what I mean? It's like you're watching people going in and out, and you're going to be one of those people in any second now going up, you know, to the portal of creativity to heaven. And you might walk out of there, you know, with a huge smile on your face, you know, that you sold something, or, you know, you might be getting called back again, or thanks, but no thanks. But still, you've gotten your shot, which is so cool.
When creative talent comes in and they know this history.
Bill Humphrey is Senior Vice President for Sunset Studios. Together, the three lots, Sunset Bronson, Sunset Gower, and Sunset Las Palmas, have 37 high-tech sound stages on ground spanning more than 40 acres. The Sunset Bronson lot, where I'm talking with Humphrey, is marked by KTLA's original 1925 radio tower, proudly standing guard.
If you walk down the hall here, we're now in the mansion of the old Warner Brothers headquarters, which is now part of our Netflix complex. Down at the end, you'll see these three circles in the ceiling, which was the executive house of Jack Warner. Looney Tunes. Bugs Bunny coming through the three circles. He looked up and goes, let's use that as a symbol for Looney Tunes.
So that became the logo.
The mansion, this was the original Warner Brothers headquarters. And Jack Warner's brother supposedly didn't like it so much. So this is about a length of a football field. So they had offices on either end. So they never interact with each other. But they still made movies. Also back then, they were the first company to bring radio to the West Coast.
Continued innovation, says Humphrey, means keeping up with changing needs. That usually means plenty of space for people to work, think, and create. New buildings have already gone up here for Technicolor and Netflix, and another creative tower is set to open next year. The goal is to bring different production departments closer together to actual production facilities.
I always call it sort of the media tech intersection. Technology people and media people and creative people all can work together toward this goal of creating great product for global distribution very rapidly.
But this fast factory model does have its critics.
I'd prefer a diverse media environment.
Emerson College professor Jane Shattuck is currently writing a book about Netflix.
There is fear in global theory that we are turning out this American product, but it's not only American, it's this kind of generalized global product, that we're, you know, this kind of, as people can have an IKEA apartment, you know, with a, and look exactly like their neighbor.
But in the end, who are we to judge how these next 100 years should play out for Sunset Studios? Perhaps no one really should. That is, unless...
You are about to enter the courtroom of Judge Judith Scheindlin.
For The Frame, I'm Marcos Najera.
And just a little news before we go. Hollywood's award season is underway, and The Irishman has been named the year's best film by both the New York Film Critics Circle and the National Board of Review. For Best Director, the New York critics went with Benny and Josh Safdie, the brothers who made the upcoming Uncut Gems. And the National Board of Review chose Quentin Tarantino for directing Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. And that'll do it for today. I'm John Horn at the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC. We'll see you tomorrow.